tuned to Troy Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. This is your host, Bathrobes Pierre Robert Norris. Stay with us for 2 hours of mostly live interaction with guest George Cavallo, psychiatric ombudsperson, special mystery guest, a rainbow family traveler from Germany, and our own Shaz, the Widget Man, joining us as co-host. Stay tuned, 2 hours. And of course, a call-in top line at 427-3772. This is your host, Bathrobes Pierre Robert Norris, and we're going to begin this edition of Bathrobes Pierre's Broadsides with a reading of a memorial to a homeless activist in Santa Barbara. A man named Don Hamilton died in 1998 this year. He was born in 1927. I knew him when I worked down there 5 years ago. He was a Communist Party person, and some of the best people on domestic issues came out of the Communist Party. Their position internationally, in my mind, was crazy and subservient to Soviet foreign policy, but their actions domestically in terms of struggling for the rights of poor people was unparalleled. They were out there at the head of the civil rights movement before anyone ever heard of Martin Luther King or Rosa May Parks. And I'm going to read this memorial to Don Hamilton. On July 8th, Don Hamilton's familiar figure in Santa Barbara and a vocal and vehement advocate for the marginalized, insulted, and injured among us died after several months of what appeared to have been shoddy care and mistreatment at the Veterans Administration Hospital in West Los Angeles. A fierce and dedicated homeless activist, Don was a familiar figure on Santa Barbara's streets and its jails and at city council meetings or at demonstrations up and down the state. He was a friend of mine and also, I think, a pretty good man, and both the life he led and the way he died are worthy of attention. First, his death. I have been told the details by Maureen Gildea, a close friend of Don's who visited him regularly in the hospital and had his power of attorney. It is not a story for the squeamish, but it should be told. Don went down to the hospital in late February because of back problems. He has spent much of his past few years in a wheelchair. He was having problems with the circulation in his legs, and on February 26th was to be operated on for a clotted artery. Apparently, when he was on the table, the doctor discovered a malfunctioning kidney, so they removed it. Then Don apparently had a massive heart attack and had to be taken from the table before his leg could be done. For the next month, in intensive care, he was on a respirator and received dialysis every other day. Because he was agitated, his hands were tied to the bed. He could neither speak nor gesture, and so he communicated with Maureen when she went to see him by nodding and blinking his eyes. Gangrene set in on his legs. Maureen, who has had some medical training, says the problem had not advanced beyond the toes of one foot and the ankle of the other. The doctors assured her and Don that they would cut off both legs only below the knee. but they amputated both legs, as Maureen puts it, clear up to his bottom. There was nothing left, not even stumps. Depressed, Don refused to go back on the dialysis machine, but Maureen pleaded with him, and he relented. For the next 2 months again, neither speaking nor gesturing, Don lay in intensive care. Terrible bed sores developed on his body and became infected. Maureen begged the staff to raise Don off the bed so the air could circulate beneath him, but they merely turned him from side to side, a strategy that did not work because the sores already extended to his hips. Horrified, Maureen, after much labor, found another hospital to take Don as a charity patient. He arrived there suffering from pneumonia, kidney failure, a bulky heart, and an infection that had spread from the bed sores to the wounds left from his operations. His new doctor said, "We've gotten him too late." They told Maureen they had never seen bed sores as bad as Don's and immediately did what Maureen had begged the VA doctors to do. They raised Don off the bed with air pillows and tubes in an attempt to heal the wounds. It didn't work. The infection worsened. Finally, they decided to operate to clean out the infection. Don died on the table. The immediate causes listed on the death certificate were pneumonia, cardiac arrest, respiratory failure, and infection. The bed sores were given as a contributory factor. In the end, Don Hamilton fell into the hands of an indifferent and perhaps criminal bureaucracy of the kind against which he had fought for much of his life. It is impossible to imagine without rage and some fear what those last few months were like for Don, as restless and rebellious as he was. And totally alone, except for Maureen's visits, and trapped in a useless body strapped to a bed, unable to protest or escape. But that's not the end of it either. Both the mortuary to which Don's body was sent and L.A. County, which was to cremate it, lost track of the body. For 3 weeks, Maureen received neither help nor information from either source, and it was only a week or so ago when I mentioned to the VA hospital something about complaints and possible suits that the situation changed. Of course. Within an hour, someone had gotten back to Maureen with the news, surprise, that the body had been found. Don Hamilton did not often speak about the past, even to close friends. The details of his life are sketchy and do not explain much, in the end, about Don's passions. He was born in Tennessee in 1927. He attended high school in Burbank, California, but may not have graduated. He joined the Merchant Marine during World War II, and after the war, he became a seaman and saw the world. For a while, early on, he was a member of the Communist Party and worked for the Marine Union, though he seems surprised to have had a lot of trouble with both organizations. He lived in New York for a while. He was married early in the 50s and divorced in 1955. The cause was desertion, though it is not clear what that meant. There were two small sons from the marriage from whom he remained estranged throughout his life. Later, he worked with the United Farm Workers Unique in California, telling several friends that he was a chauffeur for Cesar Chavez. He must by that point have ended his life as a seaman, perhaps because of the back injury that was to bother him late in life. In 1980 or so, he was living in Thousand Oaks when he read a piece in the Santa Barbara News Press about a demonstration there, which drew him to Santa Barbara. He lived at first in an apartment on Garden Street, which was then homeless for several years, and finally qualified perhaps 8 years later for public housing, where he lived until he died. Since his arrival in Santa Barbara, Don was involved in many different kinds of causes, protests, and movements, both locally and elsewhere. Almost all had to do primarily with the disenfranchised and the poor, and more often than not with families, women, and children. For many years, Don was involved with the Homeless Coalition, which for a time was perhaps the most effective grassroots homeless organization in America. The coalition of homeless activists and middle-class advocates brought about enormous changes in Santa Barbara, including creation of the first non-sectarian shelter for homeless men and the suspension of the city's laws against camping and sleeping, a change that was unfortunately only temporary. The coalition gradually lost its energy and effectiveness as its participants fell away one by one, exhausted by the endless struggle to counterbalance the city's odious attempts to run the homeless out of town or off the streets in the name of progress, tourism, and business. Don was one of the few who kept on with the struggle. He founded and announced himself the spokesperson for the Tri-Counties Council of the Unemployed and Homeless, an organization with few members that may have existed mainly in his mind, but which nonetheless provided an official platform for his actions. There he'd be, always, at city council meetings or protest demonstrations or on solitary vigils he kept outside of City Hall, drawing attention to one injustice or another, trying to get the authorities or citizens to right some wrong, or at least my goodness that's about all I've got for the Don story. And this is an article by Peter Marin, which we were talking about Don Hamilton, the Santa Barbara activist who, as I've just been reading, died recently, very recently. Actually, we've got the end of the story. I'm going to skip to that. In a week or two, when the problems surrounding Don's body are sorted out, it will be shipped up here to Santa Barbara and cremated. Then his friends will have a small ceremony to honor him. The original plan was to scatter the ashes at sea because Don was a seaman, but maybe, too, we should take at least a handful of ashes and scatter them outside City Hall at the foot of the tree under which Don held his vigils. I believe there are laws against that, and if things turn out as they usually do, maybe a cop will come along and be tempted to arrest someone. What more fitting end or tribute could there be for Don? One last memorial confrontation and bust. It seems only right. Cry freedom for a moment for Don. That's by Peter Marin, a Santa Barbara writer and activist who actually accompanied the Santa Barbara homeless in their famous march across the country. They marched all the way from Santa Barbara, California to Washington, D.C. in 1988 to seek basic rights for homeless people. Now, I worked in Santa Barbara in 1992 and 93 for the Legal Defense Center and for attorney Will Hastings, who I called this evening to talk to him and to get his sense of what was going on in the final days of Don Hamilton. He's going to give us a little update on what happened, and then we're going to turn to our first guest as soon as he arrives.
I'll do that.
Thank you.
Wild Will, you have known Don Hamilton, a homeless activist of the most, stubborn sort, one would say. When others deserted the vigils, he was there alone.
You might call him irascible.
I would indeed. I knew Don, of course, in the early 90s when I was working under you as a sort of a homeless advocate in your legal office, but you knew Don for a decade before that when you defended the homeless and were able to establish such rights as the right to vote in Santa Barbara, and actually were able, through successful protest and the threat of a mass ingress into Santa Barbara by homeless throughout the country, to end their sleeping ban for 3 years. Don died recently under rather tragic circumstances, disgraceful circumstances. Do you want to give us sort of the background on that?
Well, all I know is that he was having problems with circulation in his legs, and there was no place for him to go except to the Veterans Administration Hospital, where he had been before several times. Tested, really hated that place. He said, I don't want to go there because people go there to die. And poor some bitch, that's what happened. He went down there and he died.
This was in Santa Barbara or in another city?
Pardon?
What city was this hospital in?
I believe it was Wadsworth in West Los Angeles.
I will have read or will be reading on the radio the obituary for Don by Peter Marin, the articulate Santa Barbara writer. But can you tell us something about what Don did as an activist, what kinds of struggles he was involved in, what you remember about him?
Well, again, you're asking me to write an article that I've already declined to do because I don't have all the information.
Mm-hmm.
Well, all I can do is just broadly sketch it and say he was there and available and volunteering for every cause that affected the homeless. And if he didn't agree with the majority opinion, he would spend his own money and publish in the name of another organization that he controlled his own opinion.
Mm-hmm.
He was certainly a gadfly, and I'm proud to have ridden river with him.
I know that after the after the city kind of agreed to suspend the sleeping ban in some areas, I guess not in parks and not on the beaches, after the 1986 demonstrations, and that was a ban that lasted until it was overthrown by the courts in 1989 by an irascible right-wing judge, perhaps even more irascible in his role than Don Hamilton, Don was also active in protests at City Hall to try to expand homeless services. In order to get rid of Don from the City Hall, they actually created a law making the City Hall off limits. Isn't that right?
That's correct. And we attacked that in court, and we had good reason to attack it, but we weren't successful.
And so there is a Don Hamilton ban at City Hall so that he and his ilk will not show up presenting a public protest about the city's negligence and indifference to basic human rights around homeless people.
Well, you're partially correct, but it's only between the hours of 7 p.m. and perhaps 9 a.m. the next day. You can do all of the above, you know, if you do it during daylight hours.
So you could discreetly disappear into the bushes at night, however, lest you find temporary residents in the drunk tank in jail.
Right.
Now, Santa Barbara passed a sitting ban a couple of years ago. I guess it was last year in the summer, and I know that people took to the streets to protest it, and there were tickets issued. And you've been kind of away from that struggle, and I don't expect you to be giving us an up-to-date, you know, the moment account. But any broad statements about the situation for homeless rights in Santa Barbara in the last year or two?
Yes, a very broad statement that Mitch Snyder came here, must have been perhaps two decades ago, and he saw the situation, and he said, you know, Santa Barbara is really a mean-spirited city, and it's in the way it treats the homeless, and I would say categorically that there's been no change. There's still a mean-spirited city.
Well, there are those who want to turn Santa Cruz, which is has its own particularly foul brand of spirit, into Santa Barbara in terms of, say, redevelopment and running out the last of the low-income folks in what we call the Beach Flats area here in Santa Cruz. Santa Barbara, I know, you know, had made promises for some kinds of facilities for children and poor people around the Fess Parker property down near the waterfront. And that was, a point of protest for a number of homeless activists for the last 5 years, on and off. And as I understand it, the redevelopers have kind of had their way in Santa Barbara. Is that accurate?
I would say that's very correct.
Well, so what's the story? Is there a new brand of homeless activists that has taken up the torch of the old, fiery 80s Santa Barbara Homeless Coalition? Or have you become a backwater in the torrential river of homeless activism?
No, I would say there's not a new brand. We still have the old curmudgeons like Cobblestone Colin, who continues to defy Santa Barbara's law on free speech by singing on the sidewalks, and by people like Protest Bob, who continues to spit in the face of the mean-spirited elders of the city of Santa Barbara by requesting more public restrooms for availability on the part of the homeless. And you know the rest of them, and time doesn't permit us to name them all. But no, the old cadre, the small, militant cadre is still here and, you know, active in its own way.
Lessened by one by the death of Don Hamilton.
Right.
Now, I was asked to question you because the subject has been coming up again and again in Santa Cruz in the wake of our attempt to repeal the sleeping ban, an initiative which fell short, but we're continuing to press through protests like Don't Sleep Tonight Night every month and a sleeping ban summits in order to get input on similar laws in different cities throughout the state. In 1986, when your city council repealed the sleeping ban in part in Santa Barbara, but not the camping ban, we must say, I guess, was there a so-called magnet effect? Did people from across the country flock to Santa Barbara to take advantage of the shady trees, the wonderful sidewalks, and the spacious streets of the town?
No, the magnet theory about attracting the homeless from across the country because there's a free spirit in Santa Barbara was a propaganda tool promoted by the maggots of Santa Barbara who wanted the homeless out. The homeless have always been in Santa Barbara. They've been here since the early 1900s when the railroad used to drop them off in lovely downtown Santa Barbara, and it's continued that way, and it hasn't stopped. There has been perhaps no overflow. I would suggest that the figures remain constant, that there is a certain amount of homeless people here since 1910.
So you would say then that you read no editorials and articles documenting or alleging a vast influx of homeless between 1986 and 1989, or a significant increase?
Well, I've read editorials and opinions, but as a lawyer, you know, I always like to see empirical evidence, and these opinions and these editorials sadly lack that empirical evidence.
Did you, as a person with some association with social service providers, hear complaints from social service providers that their food services were being overtaxed, or that their shelter services were being, pushed to the max because of this sleeping ban? Or perhaps you might say the opposite occurred, because people no longer had to run into shelters to hide from the police. There was less of that. But what did you hear during those years?
The number of social service providers were quite a few, and employed by the county of Santa Barbara, and only echoed the things that I have tried to briefly outline here.
You mean mainly that there was no such magnet theory influx?
Yes.
Well, if only that wisdom had been learned by our wise city mothers and fathers up here in beautiful Santa Cruz, how happy we would be. However, unfortunately, I guess the same debate has to be repeated again and again in city after city. And I want to thank you, Will Hastings, for kind of giving us a brief update on Santa Barbara, and also a brief memorial to the man you used to call Commie Don Hamilton.
Commie Don, yes. And may I just add to the good city fathers and mothers of the city of Santa Cruz that if each of them had an extra head, it would be lonely.
Thank you, Hastings.
It's time to decide, but it should mean it's not the time, but just the dreams that die. And sometimes when the room is still, time is so much truth to give, leaves you by the windowsill so tight. Without a wing,
without a wing,
to
take you high,
without a clue,
without a clue,
to tell you why,
to tell you why.
Now I just want to keep my name, not bother anybody's game. That idea is a golden fame.
Rolling home.
you're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM in Santa Cruz. This is Bathroom Spears Broadside, Civil Rights for the Poor. We have a packed studio with guests galore, including George Cavallo, psychiatric ombudsperson. We have Jerry, who's got some words of her own, some sharp comments about the psychiatric system as it's involved her and those she knows. We've got our alternate host, who will be taking over if I faint or get committed, Shaz, who's our local widget man and a man who's engaging in his own brand of defending civil rights on the streets in Santa Cruz. And, of course, we have you out there in the listening audience. Studio call-in line is 427-3772. Our lines are open. I will direct my guests here to keep an eye on the board in case I miss it. There's a flashing light here, which when it flashes, it means the phone is ringing. Let me know in case I forget, and we will make sure that everybody who calls in gets a chance to speak at least once. This is 96.3 FM again. The call-in number is 427-3772. A week ago, George, and we're talking to George Cavallo here, you and I talked for about an hour around the issues of the kind of the process by which an individual's liberties can be taken away from them without a trial by his peers. That is the psychiatric commitment process, the 5150, 5250, 5350 laws, which allow respectively for 3-day, 14-day, and I guess 30-day or temporary conservatorship holds. And we talked about the standards of evidence there. We talked about you have to be shown to be gravely disabled, danger to yourself or danger to others under the Landrieu-Petrus Short Act. Is that, that's what it is? We talked about how you can refuse drugs, if forcible medication, through what's called a request for a Reis hearing before you can be forced to take drugs. But apparently doctors can attempt to medicate you within 24 hours. Actually, they can get such a hearing within 24 hours, as I understand it, and then usually they win 80% of those hearings or more. Actually, 99 out of 100, I think, is what we found out. And then the other thing we discussed was writs of habeas corpus, the way you can actually get before a real judge. These other forms of hearing are not before a judge. They are before either an attorney who's part of the psychiatric system or some kind of another person who doesn't really have the so-called judicial independence, though, of course, you've heard me many a time criticize local judges as being far from independent. So we're going to be getting into kind of following up on some of these issues. We were going to have George on for the full 2 hours. Who knows? He may stay for the 2 hours anyway. I mean, he's getting a little revved up looking at some of the stuff I've been showing him. But unless we get a lot of calls on the psychiatric issue, we're going to kind of postpone that show, the longer version, for later time. But he will be on with us at least until nearly 7. And I'm going to invite you again to call in. At the moment, however, we have a caller on the line. Kitty, who wants to talk, I think, about another issue than the psychiatric abuse issue that I'm talking up.
Here, I think. All right, now we do. We have you on the line. Okay, caller, go ahead. What's your comment or question?
Okay, totally off the issue. It's about the beach plan.
Uh huh.
Few things that I have real questions about. It's questions that nobody else has.
Mm-hmm.
One, by removing everything that has been removed in the beach plan so far, in like an attempt to pacify some of the unpacifiable, I'm wondering if it has not become like a chicken pot pie, which if you, one person takes out the peas because they don't like them, and one person takes out the carrots because they don't like them, and the potatoes and the chicken and the sauce, you thus end up with it collapsing. And that's one of my questions, is are we taking out too much? It's not that I agree with the whole plan, but I agree with a lot of it, and we certainly need something. I also have a question that are some people against the plan, or any plan, because they haven't seemed to be able to come up with one themselves either, because it would sooner or later force them to clean up and improve their properties? Because once everything becomes built or done or improved or expanded, some people's property would certainly have to follow, or it would look like a real slum in certain areas. Next, I also question if some people raise such a stink because they want to draw attention to themselves, either for their 30 seconds in the spotlight or because they desire to be noticed in hopes that Mr. Canfield or someone else will offer some outrageous price for their properties. Another thing, how can someone be what seems to be arrogant and greedy that they want not to improve an area that affects everyone and it has obvious problems? It seems like people are complaining about their shower drains running into the streets and drug problems, and then they complain about the plan that can correct some of these things. It just doesn't make sense.
Well, caller, this actually, of course, is a series of relevant questions. The only trouble is it's the wrong segment. We don't, we're in the middle of the psychiatric discussion, but I think that we have someone who's going to be coming in within half an hour who may be able to address these questions, and certainly these questions will be brought up and discussed at the Sunday show from 11 to 1:30.
Okay.
And we have been bringing them up. I can't really answer for anybody else, and I would like to, you know, have you face an intelligent and informed opponent who can give you, you know, an answer to your questions, or at least her or his point of view on that might, if not satisfy, at least make you think that there's some substance on the other side.
Okay.
But I think if you stay tuned, you may hear us trying to address those questions when that topic comes around. If you can, if you got access to a radio, then why don't you do that?
Okay, I will.
All right.
Thanks.
Yeah, and we definitely will turn to the question of the beach flats as we do. I'm particularly interested in it as it concerns homeless people. And in fact, that's going to be, I guess, one of the questions I was going to ask you, George, around the loss of housing in that area. I guess the caller's questions did not concern the loss of housing. She seems to feel it's a good plan or partially a good plan. And I don't know, we aren't really in the midst of that plan right now. Is there anything you want to say about, did you hear the caller's questions? Any comments?
No, I wasn't really listening because I was looking at this other paper here, and I really don't think I can give an informed opinion at this point.
Anybody else?
I'll give it a shot in saying that the Seaside Company or the Santa Cruz Beach Boardwalk that's fostering all of these plans, I don't know in my experience and in the experience of a majority of the people that I've talked to that at this point, their company is putting the interest of the public, the people that visit there and the people that patronize them in the community, ahead of their agenda now. You know, I've personally been damaged by them. I have legal matters pending against them. And if you don't know who this is Shaw's Mr. Fidget, the fellow who invented the little fidgets. And my case is over there in court, and it's going to be a big mess as time goes on because they aren't treating people with respect now. So now, do we want to double the acreage or triple the acreage that they have to continue to, you know, hire abusive security and, you know, perform basically slave wage labor practices with the underage workers, which is basically what they're doing, keeping people past midnight that are under 18, which is against the federal labor laws. So I think that really the company needs to be looked into, and I'm sorry to eat up this time of this segment on that, but that's what I think.
Sure, and I think regarding the caller's other questions, again, I'm hoping that they can be re-asked in the context of a sort of a more focused discussion on the beach flats. I think I don't see the people who I've interviewed as being particularly interested in directing public attention to themselves. I think they'd rather be doing something else. These are women who have families to raise and so forth, mostly. I don't know. I have Phil Baer on the air a lot. I think he is really concerned that numbers of people are going to be swept away, including, I guess, I don't know if his own house is involved in the beach flats so-called Third Street realignment. And again, the question of an alternative plan, that of course has always been, I've actually proposed that to advocates as well. How about an alternative plan? And I guess their general response has been, you don't need to have an alternative plan if you're presented with a bad one. And if the motivations for this plan seems fundamentally designed to aggrandize the Seaside Company and to provide it with a large amount of revenue, a much larger amount of revenue than the city will be getting back in return. again, I don't want to speak for other people, so I'm going to let that question rest for now, and perhaps we can take it up later. And turn back to George and your psychiatric, your work as a person who informs those who are incarcerated or who face incarceration and forced drugging of their rights, and who tries to keep their heads above the water in this struggle, at least to be able to get out of the situation they're in. Now, of course, I see that I've gotten you somewhat agitated by presenting you with these faxes.
I say upset, not agitated.
Well, I think you may need a psychiatric evaluation. Dr. Jerry, do you think that this man is gravely disabled?
No, I do not see any.
Perhaps a danger to himself?
I haven't read the faxes.
Possibly dangerous to others. Definitely dangerous to certain authorities, perhaps. Well, perhaps not dangerous enough. You're paid by the county to advocate for people inside institutions, right?
That's not quite correct. Our agency has a funding source from the county, and we're on subcontract to provide advocacy services. So we don't work for the county per se. But that might be a bit of semantics there.
But you are funded by, who funds you?
A large part comes from County Mental Health. Large part comes from United Way, city and county grants. And let's see, and the ombudsman side gets funding from federal agencies.
You know, when we talked about this issue last week, you gave me the sad story that it's only 1 out of 100 Reese hearings, the right to refuse treatment that doctors want to routinely force on people, that you win. It's only 20% of cert hearings, the right to regain your liberty once you're facing a 14-day hold, that you win. And, of course, you're not involved with the writ of habeas corpus, which actually was the most recent means by which one homeless advocate, activist, Chris Brozda, got out of jail and is once again on the streets seeking to sleep in his van, perhaps unsuccessfully, since it's illegal, of course, in Santa Cruz to do that, without being harassed. He was in 72 days, again, not because he was found... I guess they couldn't find he was a danger to others. They couldn't find he was a danger to himself. So instead, they pulled in a five-minute interview with a psychiatrist, a court-appointed psychiatrist, that claimed he was gravely disabled because he was homeless and living in his van, which, of course, would make the entire homeless population of Santa Cruz certifiable. I think probably the psychiatric establishment and the judges are certifiable if they want to engage in that kind of restriction of our basic rights. But again, I don't run the show here. Just my point of view.
Sounds like they got confused. It was supposed to be 72 hours, not 72 days.
Right. Well, actually, he wasn't held by the hospital for 72 days. He was held by the jails on a charge of disturbing the peace, and that had to do with the fact that he had an unsightly appearance in Marini's candy store, and they didn't like the way he was looking there. They told him to leave. He did agree to leave, but He repeated to the officer who had asked him to leave, in apparently a low tone of voice, what he had told Lieutenant Velasis, a police lieutenant in the Santa Cruz Police Department, several days before, when he went and tried to get a complaint form and was told he couldn't have a complaint form by Sergeant Sanderson. He was told that he conveyed to the police department a challenge. I said, a peaceful challenge, that I want to challenge any police officer or anyone in the department in an arena with a referee with fixed rules, either a kung fu, a karate contest, where we could essentially sublimate our aggressions so the police officers could stop harassing me and stop acting out their hostilities against homeless people and such in a fashion that... would be maybe make some money for a charity or something. And he conveyed this to Lieutenant Velasquez, and he repeated this essentially one might regard it as somewhat eccentric or far-fetched, but certainly not a menacing challenge. And for that, he was arrested on a misdemeanor charge, two of them actually, of threatening to fight and disturbing the peace, and held in jail for 72 days. Now, actually, some of that time, because they couldn't continue to hold him in jail without trying him, that would be, you can only hold someone in jail for 30 days in custody on a misdemeanor before you have to try them or release them. They couldn't do that. So instead, they put him in the hospital for a while. Then they tried to conserve him. him. He was shipped off to Harbor Hills, but he won his writ of habeas corpus. The only reason, however, that he was able to do that, apparently, was because he had his father testify that he didn't plan to live in a van in Santa Cruz, but that he had, for example, a facility, a piece of property, a county or two over that he could go to. Whether that's still feasible, I don't know. But I know that this calls into question the civil rights of every homeless person in this area. If police don't like Brozda's behavior, if Judge Salazar, who's the judge that this in whose court this appeared, Commissioner Salazar, doesn't like Brozda's behavior, he's got to find some other way than removing his constitutional rights to deal with him. Brozda has now been barred from the mall. He's not allowed to be on the mall at all. That's a condition of his probation, which he has reaccepted probably because he's damn tired of being in jail for 72 days. Now, let me get back to where I was, having gone through that incredible long description, which I guess many of our listeners already know about, because I've been following this case somewhat closely. You've been, some would say, George, that here you are, you're paid by the psychiatric establishment, by the local, you know, mucky-mucks, to present an appearance of advocacy. And yet we've learned that your ability to influence, to effectively influence and secure rights for individuals in the psychiatric system seems to be extremely limited. Are you a sort of a, what would one say, a rose petal, a fig leaf? Are you a token? What's that about?
Well, this question I've often asked myself. I mean, how effective am I as an advocate in this county? And Kathleen, if you're listening, please call in. In this county, there's 2,500 people that I'm responsible to. Now, not all at one time, but that's pretty much the folks that are on the rolls in the mental health system. That does include also Harbor Hills and the folks that are incarcerated at the Dominican Mental Health Unit. Hello. So, to say that I'm ineffective, probably from my clients, many of my clients' point of view, would be accurate. Whether I do any good, I think I do. I think there's some level of effectiveness that I'm able to bring about. Even in the moment, if it's just modeling a different kind of behavior than the folks in the mental health system usually do. Come on in. So, for instance, like listening to somebody or giving eye contact to somebody. Boy, we're getting a load of folks here. But I'll turn it over to Robert now.
Right, we're being invaded by more guests here, which is fine. I'm glad we're doing it. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. This is Free Radio in Santa Cruz, the station that you can call and speak your mind on. And our call-in line is 427-3772. It's open. We're talking to George Cavallo, psychiatric ombudsperson. Go ahead, George.
You know, one thing I'm hoping with this forum here, that people who have been in the mental health system or who are currently in the mental health system would actually call up to say how the system has abused them, or perhaps even about how ineffectual I've been as their advocate. And they don't need to give their names because confidentiality needs to be respected. But if you have anything you want to share or ask questions about, I would encourage you, especially if you just want to share your wounds from the system. I think that's very healing, and I think this would be a good forum to do that.
And so all you folks who've had your run-ins with the psychiatric system here, give a call to 427-3772 to let the rest of us know the kinds of things you've faced and how you're doing now, so we can understand what's going on. If you have questions about the psychiatric system, and more important, if you have solutions and alternatives to the psychiatric system, that is really what we need and what we want, because the real question comes up when someone feels like they're going bananas, when people enter states of mind where they're just very, very upset, going through life crises of different kind. We have got to develop alternatives for people other than the institutionally forced drugging, forced commitment, and endless alienation that is the way things are in modern America and in modern Santa Cruz. The priorities, as we know, are gentrification, the priorities are money, the priorities are a very rigid kind of system that we're in the midst of, and with the space being squeezed out on the sides. Let's see if we got anything you want to say about anything you've heard so far, Jerry. You're a mom who's had problems. I don't know whether the psychiatric system or CPS and the psychiatric system or a combination. Any, don't feel obliged to say anything, but do you have any comments?
I have such a wide variety of comments, I hardly know where to start. I was told that by one of the so-called professional workers I'm involved with that I needed to take a psychiatric evaluation, I believe. It was in the hopes that they could medicate me.